Okay, so you are in session 122, and the title is Liquid Assets. I'm supposed to read this script, but I might just kind of improvise because they can't tell me what to do. Oh, I'm Paul Malin, by the way, moderating this session. Okay, so please turn off your cell phones and be respectful and attentive. We want to make sure we can have thoughtful and respectful dialogue. So I'm not much of a bruiser, but I'll ask you to leave if you get out of hand, I guess. If you'd like to purchase a recording of this session, you can get it at the registration desk. And you can also get a free issue of Sunstone Magazine if you subscribe during the conference. And there are some nice branded Skullcandy headphones downstairs that would help support the Sunstone Symposium. You'll find the benchmarks, books, tables downstairs as well. This is a 60-minute session, so we need to be conscious of the time and make sure that we're respectful of the group coming in behind us. So after the presentations, we'll have time for questions and answers, and I may need to cut you off. Don't take it personally if you're in line and I need to stop for time. Okay, this presentation seeks to quantify the financial impact of climate change on the LDS Church. The LDS Church owns over $1 billion in real estate in Florida and continues to buy land and build multimillion-dollar buildings there. How much of that is likely to be underwater within a few decades due to climate change? This is just the beginning of financial and moral problems that the church faces from environmental challenges that have so far remained unaddressed. The speakers include Mark Thomas, who has a career in public finance, including experience in real estate valuation. He helped in the financing of hundreds of millions of dollars of capital improvements throughout the Western United States. And D. Michael Quinn, who has a PhD in history from Yale University and is an affiliated scholar at the University of Southern California Center for Feminist Research. He has been a full-time researcher and writer, a professor of history at Brigham Young University, and a visiting professor of history at Yale. His accolades include Best Book Awards from the American Historical Association and the Mormon History Association. So we will start with Mark, and then afterwards, Michael Quinn will reply.
It's wonderful to see so many friends in the audience and people that I've known for years. And one person I would like to thank, and this is totally irrelevant to the point that I'm making today, but is Sandra Tanner. Uh-oh. She's going to be speaking with me on a panel on Saturday. I don't think she understands the impact that she and her husband had on me, the positive impact, in really introducing me to Mormon studies. And in many ways, we're still working out to this day the issues that she and her husband brought to the fore. So I'd just like to publicly thank her for that and what she got started. Often it's easy to throw rocks at her, but I don't feel that way. And we still owe a great debt to her, as well as to Michael Quinn, whom you all know, and to the people that I represent, the Association of Incompetent Mormon Scholars. So, okay. No, it was incompetent. Yes, you heard it right. Allison Higgins is the director for sustainability in Key West, Florida. And she's part of the counties down in all of southern Florida that recognize that they're in serious trouble. Their goal is not to try to save Key West, which is a great destination. They're just trying to save part of it as long as possible. The airport, the sewer system, they've essentially realized that it's just a matter of time. As she put it, in the end, we are going under. And here's part of the text of President Uchtdorf's address, prayer, in the Fort Lauderdale Temple on May 4, 2014. We dedicate the walls and windows that they may stand firm against the storms of nature and be looked upon with reverence and respect. Wilt thou protect this temple from any harm or defilement? Actually, those that know what's happening in South Florida will realize that this is asking for a great miracle to take place. The Fort Lauderdale Temple, along with most of South Florida, lies within a few feet of rising sea levels, and there's going to be a strong possibility that seawater will, due to climate change, rising sea levels will overtake the temple in a few decades. As temperatures rise, so will sea levels. It's already starting to happen. Stacy Kiner, a 30-year resident of South Florida, reports that in the past 5 years, high tides are washing into the beachfront condos. These are multi-million dollar condos. And roads are regularly flooded up from the sewers. They're not sure where the water actually comes from. It's sometimes from the sea, sometimes sewer. It's coming from everywhere. And part that people call the city and say, there's water in my condo. Well, they rush out and try to figure where, what can we do? What's the, there's not a lot they can do because they don't have a high ground to stand on. This is all flat. Right now, the city's, one of the ways they are trying to prevent problems in South Florida is to get certificates of elevation. So if you're a certain, depending on the city, you can't build if you're too close, too low. But that's, of course, just delaying the inevitable. Elizabeth Colbert's article, The Siege of Miami in December 2015, New Yorker, summarizes some of the best informed opinions on sea level rises. The IPCC, which is the United Nations, kind of the gold standard for climate change, predicts that there's going to be a 3-foot rise in sea levels by the end of this century. There, I know some of the people, there's some here at the University of Utah that participated with that group, and this is a very conservative estimate, they will admit it. They didn't want to alarm people, and part of the problem with climate change experts is they don't want to alarm people, so they tend to be very, very conservative so that no one can question what they're doing. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers predicts a rise of 5 feet. NOAA predicts 6.5 feet rise in sea levels in this century. Now, again, the Southwest Florida Regional Climate Change Compact was executed by Broward, Miami-Dade, Monroe, and Palm Beach counties in January of 2010 to address this very issue. They set the agenda for climate change and what they can do about it. The governor of the state has really come out and said, we don't know how we're going to solve this problem, but we believe, you know, if we put our firm effort behind it, we can do something. So that's about as optimistic as you get. The governor, in fact, has told state employees that they are not allowed to say the word climate change. That's an edict from the governor. This made news when somebody reported this. So, but they are planning it. They are aware of the difficulty. They just don't want to discourage people from visiting Florida. This compact, again, they meet regularly. So we're not talking about fanatical groups or people that are way out in left field. We're talking about the main political leaders in South Florida all meet together, recognizing the problem, and they have to do something about it. They predicted that between the seas would rise between 31 and 61 inches by the end of the century. Now, but according to Hal Wanless, he's the chair of the University of Miami Geological Sciences, and he's not alone. There's quite a consensus that go along with Hal. These estimates are too conservative. He studied the geological history of South Florida for nearly half a century. He believes that all of South Florida may have less than a half century to go. He's stating that geologists competent in the field, many of them believe the rise in sea levels will be between 10 and 30 feet. The church owns, as was indicated in the introduction, over $1 billion worth of assets in Florida. Now, they recently purchased 383,000 acres in the Panhandle, and they have nearly $300,000 in Deseret Ranches in central Florida. And this ranch is reportedly the largest calving ranch in the United States. I've heard that it's the largest cattle ranch in the world. I'm not sure if that's true. But it's a large property, and they're beginning to actually subdivide some of it right now. But throughout the state, you have dotted places, of course, like in any state in the United States, many chapels, a number of home storage, food storage centers, family history buildings, and other sorts of real estate besides the chapels and the temples. There's two temples in Florida, by the way. So in this presentation, I'd like to look at the flooding risk to the meeting house and temples in South Florida, and then kind of project, what does that mean worldwide for the church? What does that predict in terms of what we could expect in terms of flooded properties? And the area that I'm going to be looking at is, I'll show you a map. I'm doing the old-fashioned way. I didn't have a projector. I tried to get a student to help me, but it was useless. This is Florida, and you can see down, this is from the USGS elevation map. I just tried to copy it. So what you've got here is this area, the bottom fourth of Florida is 15 to 20 feet above. That's as high as it gets in that area. This is I-75 that runs just below that. And that red area there is 5 to 10 feet above sea level, that whole area. So that's quite a bit of area if you look at it. You've got Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Key West, Marathon. And you can see here I've dotted all of the chapels that I think are going to be less than 10 feet. That's the kind of bar I'm looking at. Let's go with the most conservative estimate, 10 feet. That's 16 chapels, several of them in Miami, Miami Beach, and you're talking about millions of people here, okay? I haven't included, again, food storage and other facilities that the church owns. So you're talking about what? The lower fifth of Florida. This is essentially called South Florida, this area here. No mountains there. Okay, and that's the difficulty. If it starts flooding, where do you put the dike? You know, there's no uphill that you could wall off. Okay, so
what about the west side?
The west side. I didn't even look at the west side. You'll notice there is a red all the way up here. The red is the 10 feet. So you got it right next to the coast, all the way up the west side. I didn't even bother looking at that because I thought it was too iffy. By the way, just to give you an idea of what I did here, instead of going out and measuring the buildings and being thrown into jail, what I did is I talked to an architect that actually, and I can't give you his name because he does work for the church, an independent architect that has decades of experience with the church, and I got my figures from him in terms of square footage, what a chapel costs to build, what a temple costs to build, and so I think I have pretty reliable sources. In fact, I got the title from him. You would all know him. He's a Sunstone participant. But that's as far as I think I want to go on that. he recommended, listen, you don't have to do anything sneaky here. You just go on Google Earth and you can actually outline the square footage of the buildings and the property. It's quite clear. And then use the cost per square foot, and I'll go into that a little later. So this was all done on an individual basis, parcel by parcel. One I threw out because it looked to me, when I looked at LDS.org, and I got the addresses from LDS.org, they give you the meeting times, a little about the, you know, description of the building. So, but these are all typical buildings. You see the, 200 parking lots around a kind of a 2000 period. They all look kind of like that. Some are outsiders. There's one in Miami that looks like they bought it and doesn't look like a chapel. But most of them you would recognize as being anywhere in the Wasatch Front. They're typical LDS churches. Okay? And so on Google Earth, you can go in and you can look any angle. You can go up on top, get the square footage, and so forth. So that's the methodology I used, is just Google Earth and LDS.org that described where the chapels were. Mike? Yes, there's one, and Orlando's up here. And I gave this presentation to my family, and their first reaction from my nieces and nephews was, but what about Disneyland? Or Disney World? No, Disney World is safe. It's up here. I mean, unless we really get something disastrous, I think Mickey Mouse is okay. Okay, any other questions on that, on methodology? I'll move a little farther. Yeah, Mike? Fort Lauderdale is, this little blue star is in 20 miles from Fort Lauderdale. It's actually a subdivision. It looks to me like it's just a small extension, like Holiday is here. The Blue Star is they call it the Fort Lauderdale Temple, but it actually is in Davie, which is that's the temple. Let me show you a picture of it. Here it is. Here it is. Here. This is an artist mock-up, but it looks. I've seen pictures of it. It looks just like this. Okay. It looks something like the Los Angeles Temple. Those of you that are familiar with it, doesn't it? Oh, okay. 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 I wasn't looking carefully at the Los Angeles Temple, obviously. Okay. So this is. I think it's an attractive building. Surrounded by subdivisions. Kind of a typical, what you would expect, a typical peaceful, very nice, you know, a pool of water, which you often see in temples, an angel Moroni at the top, facing towards the beach condos. Okay, other questions? Yes.
And the sea trees that dealt with the approach to the sea.
Yeah.
Except that Florida would choose to live with that.
I'm sure they could. I'll tell you, I think the government officials are actually talking to the Dutch, and the Dutch are doing a lot of innovative things. They're very aware of what's facing them. And I'm not a water expert, so I really can't address that. But it seems to me that they're far ahead of where we are in the United States, both in New Orleans, New York, and Florida. We seem to be less. I think they've recognized the problem for much longer, and they've reclaimed much land there. Isn't that correct? So they've been working at this quite a while, and how they do that, all I know is my knowledge of Dutch water technology is simply informed by the little Dutch boy sticking his finger in the dike. So that's I can't go beyond that. Again, I'm relying on this New Yorker article that the engineers are saying that they don't know how they're going to solve this. Again, if you have water coming up through sewers, maybe you could change that. You know, there's always a way to do it. And I guess the point here is that how many millions and billions of dollars do you need to sink into this to solve the problem? I think that's what it might boil down to. Can you solve it? Yeah, you could put a dike around the whole thing. You're talking about billions of dollars, and you're probably talking about billions of dollars at stake, so it may be worth it given the price of the real estate. We'll see. The governor seems to be optimistic that something will happen, but I don't hear anybody coming up with concrete solutions. What they're doing now is a defensive battle, it seems to me. How do we avoid building in lower areas, you know, 2 feet versus 8 feet above sea level? That's a good question, though, and it's one well worth exploring. Again, that's beyond my expertise. I can't entirely address it. Okay. Any questions? Other questions? Feel free to ask them as we move along. Okay. Okay, we've looked at the map. Okay, we're looking at the meeting. What I'm doing here in this presentation is looking just at the meeting houses, throw out the one meeting house that I don't know the church really owns. They may be renting it, and I wasn't able to get that information from my secret, my very unsecret friends. So I threw that one out. So already we're talking about a conservative estimate when you look at this. And basically, I showed you the freeway. This is the freeway that runs east and west. Everything below that is below 10 feet. Now, two of those buildings, Fort Lauderdale Second Ward and the Plantation Ward, are just above that, but they are also in the same elevation. Okay? So any of you know South Florida? Any people familiar with that? Yeah, okay. Okay. So does this sound reasonable to you? In terms of the flatness of the land, I'm going by Google here, but it's pretty obvious it's flat, you know. Okay. We've looked at the map. Now, what is the value of this property, the 15 chapels and the one temple? In Davie, as I'd mentioned, is the suburb of Fort Lauderdale, is where the temple is. In the July 1st, 2011 edition of the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel, it mentioned that the acreage was 16.5 acres that the church purchased for $4.5 million. At the groundbreaking, Elder William Walker, the executive director of the church's temple department from 2007 to 2014, and a member of the Quorum of the 70 at the time, stated to reporters that the temple construction would cost, quote, tens of millions of dollars. I think that might be an overstatement. My sources tell me that a typical price for a temple is $400 per square foot, a temple of this sort. Again, there's a lot of differences. LDS.org lists in one place 28,000 square feet, in another 30,500 square feet. So it's somewhere in between there in terms of square footage. So it's easy to calculate that you're going to come up with somewhere between $11 and $12 million for the construction cost new of the temple. Okay? There's a reflection pool, there's some landscaping, other improvements, certainly parking, a lot of parking. I think once you add all of that up, the price, the $4.5 million of the land, plus the $11 to $12 million, plus throw in some for improvements, you're going to be conservatively at about $17 million for the price new of that temple when it was built, and again, dedicated 2 years ago. So now let's look, so that's the first starting point, is the temple. The next one is the 15 meeting houses. They average they average in size 3.13 acres per chapel. So I looked up the real estate listings in the Davie area, which is again Fort Lauderdale, a suburban area, which I'm taking, and I can't defend this, but I'm just taking to be representative of South Florida. All of it densely populated. Seems to be a nice area. The listings were for two acre parcels, $350,000 to $400,000. Okay? Now that's smaller size than what the chapels are. So again, I'm trying to be conservative on the estimate. Some of the chapels, several of them, are three or four, as I recall, are on commercial lots, and they'd be worth much more. But I'm ignoring that, again, to be conservative. Okay, so the 15 lots would be, once you add that up, it comes up to be $5.6 million. Now, any of you know about real estate valuation? There are three main ways of valuating property. The income approach, how much money does it bring in? Market approach, how much would it sell on the market with a buyer and a seller that are in market conditions? And the cost minus depreciation. Those are the three main ways that appraisers use to value this. Well, I am in no position because I didn't go to the church on this to actually measure and get a real careful look at the property. So this can't be considered you can't consider this precise, or you wouldn't want to invest in this without having something more detailed. So what I'm giving here is just on the conservative side, an estimate of what it would be. And what I'm taking here, there are some chapels that are sold, and so there are market value, but they're not sold often. There's an income approach, especially on the ones in commercial properties. You could estimate if somebody moved in what kind of income they could generate. But those are, because I can't really get in and do that kind of work to do a careful analysis, I did just the roughshod, what does it cost new, and let's depreciate them, let's say it's worth 25% depreciation, will give us a rough idea. Okay, that's how I took it. You can't use insurance values to do this, because insurance is not the real book value. I'm looking for a value today. Insurance is replacement cost. And if I'm correct, as pessimistic as I am, there won't be a solution unless the Dutch help save us. Okay, as we let's assume that. So I have been fairly conservative. Other than this, that the Dutch will figure it out for us, or somebody like that. So let's find out what it would cost for these 15 chapels,
and knock off. Most of these are fairly new, by the way. You don't see anything in the 30s or 40s. This is like the oldest one to me appeared to be 1970 in terms of age, just from looking at it. So most of these are fairly new. Of course, Florida is a new mission field, so that's what you would expect. Okay. So what would be a reasonable book value if we were just trying to figure out what today could you figure it out to be? The typical meeting house contains 13,909 square feet. And if you add all of that up, take the construction cost new, $250. Again, my anonymous secret architect that does chapels gave me an idea. That would be it. Take off 25% of the value would give you a kind of rough idea of what a market value might be. A book value, you might say. So you add on the temple value onto the 15 chapels, and you come up with $61.9 million, is what the current value of the 15 chapels and the Fort Lauderdale Temple would be. That's what stands in the next coming decades to be lost by flooding. Now, back to our point. Can we do something about this? Yes, it's going to cost a lot of money. But let's assume something, is there a possibility that nothing will be done? Yes, there are people there that are saying, how do we get out of this? You know, what's our exit strategy? There are already people deciding that. And if you're smart, you'll say that. I mean, you'll say that because there's a possibility nothing will be done, and this area will be abandoned. So if you are working for risk management in the LDS Church, that's the first question you want to ask. Let's say the chance is 50%. That they'll lose all of this. Is that worth considering? Absolutely. Don't you think? It's like saying, well, my house has never caught on fire, and there's only maybe a 1% chance that it will catch fire. Why should I bother? Well, we're talking about something that's much more likely to happen. The risk is pretty substantial. So I'm just talking business here. I'm not talking about anything spiritual. I'm talking about how would you, if you own property, how would you manage this property? Well, you need to do something to manage this risk. In the first place, don't build in anything below 10 feet. That's an obvious one. But it's too late now because we already have property. I guess it amazes me because the church is pretty good with money. I know some of the people that are in their investment arm, and they're really pretty good. I'm very impressed with them. But the fact is that I don't see any mention of climate change. By the way, I was at a couple of years ago, I was at a conference on climate change and the poor, how the poor will take the brunt of climate change. It was here, not far from the university campus. And we had a professor that worked with the IPCC that teaches at the University of Utah now. He's from Pakistan, a tremendous intellect. We had a representative from the Catholic Church, somebody from one of the synagogues, and we had an LDS representative. And the LDS representative was told by the church, he dealt with the poor somehow, I'm not sure, whatever that department is. Poor agencies or whatever, I don't know, whatever it is. He was told not to say the word climate change. He could talk about the poor, but he couldn't say the word climate change. So I think the governor of Florida and church representatives are in the same boat here. The problem when you don't say climate change is that nobody can talk about climate change. And you have $61.9 million worth of assets just in Florida that stand to be sunk and lost entirely. Now, aside from the religious considerations, again, we're just talking about good business practices, risk management. What do you do if a fire burns down your home? What do you do if there's an earthquake? Do you lose if you own a plant somewhere and you have $500 million sunk in that and an earthquake levels it, you say, well, that's too bad, our business is gone. You know, you don't do that. And I must say, in defense of the church, that when you look at marketing, when you look at finance, when you look at accounting, the major aspects of business, the one that is least well studied and used is risk management. But the church, given the fact that it's risk-averse, it surprises me that they don't want to talk about climate change is to their disadvantage. It's to the church's disadvantage to ignore it because it is a possibility. I think it's a certainty. And in fact, we're already seeing it. But Let's assume it's 50-50. Well, you have to do something to mitigate the risk. You have to do something to hedge against it if you want to manage money well. What I'm saying here is that this is a huge, huge blind spot in the church for reasons that I'm not quite sure, and I think it has to do with theology. I think it has to do with radical politics. Climate change, don't say that word. It's like, don't say the word devil in church. Don't say the word evil in church. That might upset people, that there is evil in the world. We don't say that, then why are we so afraid to talk about climate change and say there's a possibility this may really impact us financially? Now, off my soapbox and back to the paper, the incompetent paper. Okay, many world religions are speaking and have spoken for many years about this. The Dalai Lama, Desmond Tutu, Pope Francis this last year, if you've read his work. By the way, he said in his encyclical, or it is encyclical, I think, on the earth, that it is no longer radical to speak of collapse, societal collapse, of radical change in the world. And the poor will take the brunt of it. That's his main message. We've got to take care of the poor, because they're people with resources will survive. The global Hindu leaders, Patriarch Bartholomew, the spiritual leader of 300 million Orthodox Christians, our silence on the subject is these are main statements. When people are being told not to say the word climate change, we're being told to ignore reality, or a potential reality. And the LDS Church, interestingly enough, was built entirely on an apocalyptic vision, a fairly radical vision, that the water would be controlled by evil, which is a very ancient idea, by the way. The idea of the sea gods would come up. In Book of Revelation, Book of Daniel, you have these monsters of evil coming out of water. Water as a chaos. Water engulfing, destroying crops. In Isaiah 27, where you have the God slaying the sea monster. I mean, the idea of water as being a source of chaos seems to me to be quite natural, because it is. And so in Canaanite religion, they would come up with the idea of Baal, would be the storm god that rides upon the clouds and slays the monster of chaos. So these are very old ideas, and of course, the apocalyptic works in Daniel and Revelation tie into that notion, because it was very common. In the Ode of Solomon, for example, he talks about Christ coming in. This was a work that didn't make it into the Bible, of course. The Christ coming in and slaying the seven-headed dragon. Well, it's symbolism, and it comes from the water. The water as a source of destruction and chaos, So this is, of course, symbolic, but now we're finding it real. We're finding a reality that we have to face the monster of chaos. And it's very religious. So that we belong to this religion that taps into that 4,000-year-old symbolism of water being evil, a source of evil, a natural symbol that we all understand. And in Missouri, the Missouri River, and Joseph Smith went down there, and we take the earth to be just so literal, we take all of that, it just is hilarious. I read a book by Lynn Hilton, that talks about the Mormon view of the world, and he talks about how the earth has a soul, and the earth, which is all very nice, the earth has a soul, and the earth speaks English, and the earth understands, and who knows, maybe French and Dutch as well, as far as I know. It seems to me that we've taken what is clearly symbolic and turned it into this fanciful view of reality that doesn't make any sense to me. And maybe Sandra Tanner would say, yes, I've been saying that all along. Well, I guess that's enough of that. Now let's turn to see what else we've got going. Here's what else we've got going in the world. You think of just the United States, the low-lying areas that have coastline. San Diego on the West Coast, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Vancouver, British Columbia. How many LDS chapels and temples do we have there? Of course, there's the Los Angeles Temple. I'm not sure about that, and maybe Mike can tell us. You've got on the south, Houston, New Orleans, and of course, Florida. On the east coast, Boston, Newark, New Jersey, New York City are all major cities that the church has a presence in. In temples, we have Samoa, Fiji, Tonga, the Philippines, Taipei, Tahiti, Dominican Republic, Merida, Mexico, Fortaleza, Recife, Manaus, Brazil, two temples in Hawaii. So if you take those temples, just those, I'm just off the top of my head, there's many more. You know, we have 100 and something. If you take those 13 temples and times it by 17 million, just as a rough ballpark, you're coming up with $200 million of assets at risk without even looking at a map. Right there, close by. So what is the risk management issue here? The risk management is we're probably talking about roughly 60, $70 million in the United States, and certainly probably at least that in so we're probably talking hundreds of millions of dollars, just eyeballing the risk the church has. So I leave you with that inspirational thought, and but I'll say this. There are going to be winners and there are going to be losers. There always are. And there are always chances for opportunities. When there's going to be suffering in the world, we ought to be ready for it. And we ought to be ready to bring our help to wherever it's needed. So this isn't all doom and gloom. It can be a chance for making the world a better place. Yes?
Yeah, Mark, on the South Florida,
yeah.
Is the church self-insured on that, do you think? Or?
Now I know a good friend of mine is in the insurance. I didn't dare call him for this, though, because I think he would consider that a betrayal. But I know the church is largely self-insured. And so my suspicion is, yes. Have they addressed this? I have no idea. I don't think they would want to tell me.
Well, that would be another question. I'm
yes.
In California.
Ah.
And so if you're in a floodplain, it's extremely difficult to get flood insurance.
Yes.
So if you were like a creek or something. But I would think South Florida's going to have that right now has that exact same problem.
Yeah. That's what's going to happen, I think, unless they can solve the problem in some way that we can't foresee. Insurance companies will cease to give insurance, and banks will cease to loan, and there'll be a stagnant financial state. I see that happening pretty quickly, because the governor's not going to hide this. As much as he's trying to hide it, sooner or later people are going to in the very least, what we're going to have is financial chaos. And that's a good point. The church, given its pattern, is probably self-insuring those, and it probably will never want to tell publicly what it is doing there. That's just its style. So, yeah, good question. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Well, let's have Mike. First of all, let's have Mike respond, and then we'll have some questions. Okay.
My comments will be brief. By my standards, and unfootnoted, but I have made some additional copies that are up here, and if the interest in getting copies of my remarks is greater than the copies I've provided, then just write down your email address and on the container, the manila folder, and I'll email you a copy of my remarks. Mark Thomas has given us a provocative presentation in his case study about the nexus of religious commitments, financial expenditures, and environmental risks involving the contemporary Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Latter-day Saints, sorry. I sense a lightheartedness in the approach, but his analysis and conclusions are deadly serious. Definitely at risk, his analysis argues, are the millions of dollars in the hard-earned investments of the church, the reputation of its leaders, and even the faith of its followers. However, his complaint is about far more than the prospect of financial losses. He faults the institution and its leaders for not making the kinds of statements about our Earth's negatively changing climate that 13 states, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, the Federal Centers for Disease control, and many American cities have done in secular terms. Worse, he argues, LDS leaders have not echoed the pronouncements about the dangers of climate change made by such religious leaders as the Dalai Lama, Desmond Tutu, Pope Francis, the global Hindu leadership, and Patriarch Bartholomew, head of the Eastern Orthodox Church. Thomas could also have cited Hugh W. Nibley. For decades, BYU's religion professor gave talks and published essays critical indirectly and even directly of LDS headquarters for ignoring environmental issues in its multifaceted pronouncements. Like Jeremiah of old, rank-and-file Mormons have also raised a warning voice about humans degrading the earthly environment. And I welcome Mark Thomas adding his own voice to what should be a united chorus that will lead to environmental and corporate action, not simply individual activities. However, if one is counting environmental risks to the LDS Church's investments in temples and meeting houses, California is a better example. Along the ever-dangerous San Andreas Fault are literally billions of dollars in LDS temples and meeting houses that will be damaged or destroyed when a massive earthquake of 8 to 10 on the Richter scale finally rips through the state from north to south. Like the rising oceans of our present climate change, California's big one is inevitable. Unlike the risk to Mormon investments in South Florida, California's cataclysm is long overdue geologically. And yet, LDS headquarters keep spending millions of dollars to build vulnerable structures in California. Those comments show my native Californian bias. One could make similar statements of ecological threats to the millions of dollars in LDS temples and meeting houses within the world's most earthquake-prone country, Japan. Likewise, for those investments in the tornado alley of America's Midwestern states from Ohio to the Great Plains. Why continue building LDS temples and meeting houses amid such environmental risks? Because that is the price of promoting the restored gospel in the world of desolation we humans inhabit. That is the faith of LDS headquarters. Yes, our leaders should speak about our responsibility to avoid environmental catastrophes as best that we and our governments can. However, as medieval Christians knew too well, in the midst of life, we are in death. I resonate with that dour existential view. Thank you. Give the mic copy to you.
It occurs to me that the church really has very little incentive to have a lot of concern about environmental problems. I'm going to be a little bit more cynical than Mike and say that every one of those chapels, every one of those temples is a profit center, and they have recouped their investment many times over already. So why shouldn't they just continue to build in whether it's earthquakes or whether it's rising sea levels? Why shouldn't they just continue to build and ignore the risk?
I was happy to hear Mark speak about himself as belonging to the Association of Incompetent Scholars. I thought at first he said incontinent scholars, and I'm a little bit worried. Mike talks about California, and Mark talks about Florida. I don't know how many of you have read Orson Scott Card's novel, The People, the Folk of the Fringe, about the damming up of the waterways so that this valley completely fills up with water and the temple itself is under water. It's a very interesting fictional account of some possible prospective thing. But what I wanted to say was that A year and a half ago, I was representing the Liahona Children's Foundation, of which I'm on the board, in Kiribati, an island nation in the middle of the Pacific that has 17% of its population as Latter-day Saint. Kiribati is the first nation that will be lose all of its landmass to water, to rising seas. And the people on Kiribati have no higher ground to go to. They are trying to find land on Fiji or someplace else where they will have to go to. You think about the implications of transporting an entire nation to higher ground. And think about not simply the effect of flooding, but Mark and I have been involved in associations dealing with the lack of understanding and the lack of activism among Mormons about climate change. But you also have flooding in other places. You also have drought. You have what seems to us an enormous potential problem in the future, and even to some extent in the present, about our refusal to adequately address as a people, as a church, as a community, the problem of climate change. And it seems to me that when we think about the 25th chapter of Matthew, I can consider the least of these my great-grandchildren and my great-great-grandchildren who will be affected by our inaction, by our refusal to take seriously, and by our willingness to support politicians and others who deny that this is, if not the most serious, certainly one of the most serious problems ever faced by us as human beings. I will be teaching a course at UC Berkeley called The Vanishing Garden, Faith Traditions in the Future of the World. And I think as we as Latter-day Saints could, in fact, take leadership in a way, in a bold way, if we could see the effect of this, not simply on dollars or on chapels, but on the real lives and the deaths of many of our people that could be prevented if we were wiser and if we were more spiritually attuned to the catastrophe that awaits us.
For people listening to the audio version of this, it's really a shame that you can't sit here in this room and look out this panoramic window at the hillside behind you, and we are right at eye level with the shoreline of Lake Bonneville for this, just for perspective on rising sea levels. I go to the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and a lot of my professors are on the IPCC, and a lot of my friends have been participants in these discussions you're talking about, and it was so unbelievably depressing to go onto Facebook over the last 2 years and have my friends from Scripps talking about being in the Vatican and talking to John Paul and him issuing the Laudamus Te that you mentioned, the encyclical about how we cannot, that there will be serious consequences and they will disproportionately affect the 3 billion poorest people in the world, and that is a moral problem. And simultaneously seeing Rachel Mabee Whipple's meetings with church leaders about environmentalism, where after years and years of pressure, they were able to get a 2-minute PSA from the church saying that we are generally in favor of having a planet to live on, but don't really worry about anything. Yeah. But you shouldn't really worry too much about what we do with that planet. So I like the approach. It has been effective to talk dollars and cents with people, that you do what's called economic valuation, where you tell, for example, the government of Thailand that it would cost, to protect mangroves, costs about $50 million to build the dams that will prevent another earthquake from killing, 70% of your coastal population, costs on the order of $2 billion. It's not the only argument to be made. And in a religious context, I think it's really important that we make the moral arguments that Toby was making a second ago. that other people have made eloquently, and I think we need to make those. The final thing is, you were talking about the Dutch, and I just pulled up the government webpage on climate change, and it has 47 pages of beautiful science talking about the problem and exactly where elevation changes are happening, and then there's a section called What Will the Government Do? And that section is blank. The page ends right there.
So my name is Bryce. I kind of had a kind of a question. I'm formulating it as I'm talking right now, so pardon me if I kind of ramble a little bit, but I think there's something that needs to be said about the easy ecclesiastical intertwinement with this property we're talking about. You know, dollars and cents do make sense. We do have to talk about the actual financial implications of this. But let's say the church gets smart. Let's say they decide there's nothing we can do about this rising tide, and we have to sell our property. As an optimistic person, I would say, hey, great, you know, maybe they can turn the churches and the temples into like homeless shelters. It'd be fantastic. You know, they have bathrooms and showers and a pool in the basement. I mean, it'd be great there. But we know that that's not going to happen because, I mean, you've done a very, you know, armchair valuation of how much all of this property is worth right now. That's never going to happen. So if the church is able to sell this property, then somebody is going to have to buy it and demolish the property, demolish the temples, demolish the churches. Can we talk about how that might affect members if they start
seeing YouTube videos? If they start seeing YouTube videos of, you know, temples being blown up, being demolished to put in a strip mall or something?
He in his paper, he didn't read it, but he addresses this issue of the option of selling and the problems involved with trying to dispose of property that is at risk as much as this property is. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's the obvious moral question. Once you start talking morality, how can you dump this off on someone else? Yeah, that's got to be in the equation. You don't. Unless somebody can figure out some way of using it in the short term. Or maybe you just use it and figure out. But in any case, you need to figure out what happens if we lose this property. That's got to be in your calculation. I love your idea, though, of turning this into homeless shelters, a place. That's right. We already heard that argument. These are profit centers, but also they could be negative profit centers once they go under. That's the downside. So. What would you do? I mean, if you owned $60 million worth of property and you knew you were going to lose it, there's probably something you could do. And I like your idea. Let's make this a showcase for climate change. You could make something good out of it. Help the homeless. Help the people who are going to suffer if we don't help them in climate change. How can we make that transition from low sea to high sea? I think there are all sorts of opportunities, and that's kind of what I was suggesting earlier. Let's make this an opportunity to make the world a better place. There's certainly, but we first have to admit there's a problem, or a potential problem.
And with the church is never going to be proactive about a solution until they admit that there's a problem. I mean, we see the vast majority of the problems that the church reacts to are just reactions.
Right.
How would one go about convincing the church they need to be proactive in this case? Let's sell a property while it's not underwater.
Yeah. Well, I must say that I've heard people from the presiding bishop's office say that the church will never be a leader in earth stewardship. They've simply say that they will always, they don't want to lead the charge, let others move, and once everybody else has moved up there, then they'll move up. And at that point, they're missing opportunities, the kind you're suggesting. So there's an opportunity loss if you don't jump in, and the faith loss. And
well, just think about how people would love that if the church did, you know, let's just say converted it to homeless shelter. People would love that. And then you can see huge influx of new members coming to the church. church, it'd be benefiting the local home population, and they would say, hey, wow, this actually is an altruistic religious corporation, and maybe they actually do benefit society. They'd be able to count a number better than just, oh, we've given them $1.8 billion to charity in the last 30 years. That number's starting to get old.
Yeah, thank you.
We probably ought to move on, yeah.
Thank you.
My question is to the general finances of the church. Are there any estimates as to the total holdings, both liquid and property, that currently are at the disposal of the men that occupy the white and separate room, or less. Because whether the changes in our climate and the loss of property in the future will even make a big difference to the total holdings of this corporation may be a factor in some of their decision-making. Thank you.
Well, I have a book that is coming out possibly by December. I was told today that they have begun editing it, and that's very good news because I think I can, if once I start receiving editing, I estimate that 3 months from the time I start receiving editing of, say, the first chapter, it'll be on bookshelves for sale, for the reason that there are only 3 narrative chapters in the book, but there are 20 appendices and 30 tables. So those are hard to spend much time in editing, aside from making sure columns line up and that kind of thing. So because there are only 3 narrative chapters, once they start giving me editing, I think they will be able to move very quickly. That said, as much of an introduction. The book I will be launching and inflicting on you all talks about my estimates, and some of them are carefully drawn from sources, of income and expenditures. However, I do not, although there have been media estimates of total properties owned by the church. The church leaders, particularly Gordon B. Hinckley, have pointed out that those are income, they are income draining properties because they have to be maintained. Particularly temples, church meeting house properties, whatever, despite their value, some terms, they consume resources of the church. They do not produce income. And so for that reason, my book does not deal with estimates of total property because there is this imbalance that the church leadership frequently makes that, yes, we have billions of dollars invested in properties, which my research indicates is the case, but much of those are resource consuming. And because there is no way that I know of distinguishing between those properties which only consume and those properties which are partly are profit producing and those properties that are not profit producing because it just goes back into the maintenance of the property, I don't deal with that. And I think in many ways, even if the church were to issue detailed financial reports, I'm not sure that they would spell that out because it is so complex. But the church at one time did indicate income in some of its annual reports, and it always indicated expenditures. And I can only hope that that will one day resume as a practice of the church. But to your question, I don't think that that is something I can estimate, and I doubt that the church will ever even try to disclose.
So we're pretty much out of time if you want to go real, real quick.
I don't have any evidence in terms of direct explanations from general authorities about this matter. The most that the presiding bishop has said, for example, concerning the City Creek development is just go out and buy stuff and use it because it is income producing for the church. The argument that I make in my analysis of this question in the book, and I demonstrate it with dollars and cents in specific cases, is that the church could not have the expansion of its temples, its meeting houses, and other expenditures in the international church were it not for its commercial profits. Tithing alone cannot support that. And I have an extensive argument or bolstered or buttressed with many statistics to demonstrate that. But I am not one who is opposed to power, and I'm not one who is opposed to profit-making, even though I am a socialist. I've been a Bernie socialist since I'm my 20s, a democratic socialist. But I'm a pragmatic socialist, and I'm not opposed to wealth. It's just that spread the wealth. And I'm not opposed to churches making profits, particularly when they channel those profits into the benefit of people throughout the world, not only of their own adherents. And so I find the story of church finance and business, particularly for the last 40 years of the LDS Church, inspirational. But I recognize that not everyone here does.
Thank you all.